I would like to welcome Ian Hoskin, photographer, to Radio Gorgeous Man Week. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, Ian.
Thank you, and thanks for having me on Man Week.
Excellent. We are going to talk about, first and foremost, your photographic essay, Ladies First.
Right.
So it is a beautifully produced, really, really nicely produced, actually, little book of black and white photographs. Tell us more.
It's the culmination of a long time working. It's about 35 years in the making, principally because it was started in 1980 as part of my degree show, and then it was shelved because I couldn't get it to work completely. I rediscovered it in the attic and realised what I had to do with it and went straight forward with it. That took about 18 months from finding it to reworking it and getting it published.
And let's describe more fully what we see when we open Ladies First
without giving it away. They are pairs of images. The images are different, but the lines of text underneath each of the opposing images are the same as much as possible, apart from maybe he and she. Mm-hmm. And that gives us then the real difference between the situations that each of the genders are in, given similar circumstances.
Yes. For example, and what you're really playing with are male and female stereotypes.
Absolutely, yes.
And how, I think what really becomes apparent when you look at these twinned images and twinned statements is that men are just as trapped by these stereotypes as are women.
We all are, and I read around this subject quite a lot and realised that there's a few philosophers who write about this, that we all perform to gender type. It's a learnt role. So we are all trapped in it. It's really, the book is about looking at and examining those gender roles that we all slot into quite comfortably, but just a way of examining to try and start a dialogue about the trap that we're in.
And the photographs themselves, the people who are in the photographs are headless. And
yes,
was that purposeful?
Absolutely purposeful, so that there's no identity, because if there is a face, we attach expectations, again, stereotypes about the way that people look and how they might be, what they might sound like, who they are. So they're edited out. There's hands, there's torsos, there's bits and pieces of people.
And bits and pieces of things,
yes,
as well. And one of the things which, you know, as you pointed out, other people, as this book has come out, one, a couple of things, because you did take these photographs in the 80s.
Some of them. There are about, I don't know, 10-15% of them are the original images. The rest have been supplemented or re-photographed from originals, just to sharpen them up in an aesthetic sense and to get them to work properly with the areas that I identified with that I needed to talk about.
Mm-hmm. But it occurs to me that not much has changed since those photographs.
That's right. I think what I've realised is that everything's changed and nothing's changed. It's a case of one thing being sorted out and then something else popping up to take its place. So we sort out one thing through maybe legislation. Employers might find a way around that so that they can still pay an equal rates to men and women. And then another area crops up that we hadn't ever expected or can't legislate about, and that becomes the next thing to try and solve. There's an underlying thing to try and solve, and that's just about the inequality and the stereotyping. If we can sort that out, maybe we can sort everything out.
Yes. And then you have, but one thing that's changed in 30 years is dialogue about gender itself.
Yeah, and this is done from a binary gender perspective. It's when I had a show with this work in Atom Gallery in London, and the first two people through the door were a lesbian couple, and I thought, oh no, I haven't really thought this through. They looked round, they read it, they looked at it, they laughed in the appropriate places, and then I eventually got round to talking to them about the show, and they said, it doesn't matter what gender you are, how you look at yourself, you know, where you identify, other people place the stereotypes on top of you. So it doesn't matter what your orientation is or which gender you identify with.
And for the most part, you know, the binary system is the one that...
It's the main...
I mean, if we're talking about stereotypes...
It is still a stereotype.
And it is still... you know, certainly how we're legislated at.
Yes, we're legislated, we're viewed, we're sectioned into two distinct areas by society.
And by ourselves.
Yes,
and
it's
largely self-legislating.
Yeah, and one of the other things about this is that I think that the stereotyping isn't just done by women towards men or men towards women. It's also by your own peer group, either by age, by gender, whatever it is. It's overlaid by the people who should understand.
Yeah, and I remember because I didn't grow up in a genderless household by any means. But it wasn't a regular household. It did look traditional from the outside. My father went out to work. Mm-hmm. My mother didn't, largely because she didn't want to. but also, you know, and there weren't differing expectations of my brother to my sister and I. Almost there were more because we were girls.
Right.
And I never heard. I went to Vassar College, which is formerly an all female college, and the first time, which is university here, the first time I heard, you can't do that because you're a girl, was there.
Right. And was that about a subject or was it?
No, it was about running for you know, student political office.
All right, so.
But I hadn't heard that until then. I was like, so, what? What do you mean? What so what would that possibly have to do
so
with
you'd be,
anything?
You'd be clever enough to do physics at a degree level, but not clever enough to run for a student union.
It also just didn't occur to me, like, why would being female have anything to do with it?
Well, but this is the kind of barriers that I want to... The book isn't going to solve society's problems by the wildest stretch of imagination. It's a book. It's really about the dialogue that we can start up about this area, about why can't women do this? Why are men excluded from that? And it's all based on the expectations about gender, about stereotypes. It always comes back to that.
And why are those so enduring?
I don't know if I knew that. It's possibly, like I say in the introduction, based on outdated views of things where men chased the dinner over the savannah and the women were left to look after the elderly and the children. But that's all gone. It's all changed. It's all open for massive change now. And if we look at it from even just from a straightforward economic sense, if the main wage earner in the household is a woman and there's an election between in the couple for one person to stay at home with the children, then why not the man?
And in your case, that's what
exactly,
you and your partner decided.
Yeah. I was in teaching. Gina was in set design at the BBC, and she earned 4-5 times as much as I did. And so we would have been starving. We'd have been eating crusts and scraping about. So it was an obvious choice for us. She went back to work about 2 months after the birth of each of our children, and I was at home. It was just natural. It was fairly straightforward. We had all sorts of pressure from other friends.
I was going to say, it made sense internally within
internally,
your family.
It didn't make sense to...
I was going to say, at the school gates, how was that?
When she got to the school gates, it was 4 and a bit years down the line, I think there was chatter amongst those who were all female and with their children or were nannies that something dreadful must have happened in our household, that maybe my wife had died of cancer, or there was a lot of speculation, which I only became aware of afterwards. And it's a bit sad, isn't it, that just because you turn up at the school gates as a dad, something dramatic has happened in your life to justify that.
Meanwhile, we're all saying, oh, the fathers have to be more involved. Yes, the fathers have to be more involved. Yes. Ew, he's involved.
Yes, yeah.
Creepy.
Yeah. But it did mean that I couldn't join in socially as much as a lot of the mums would when they would all go around to each other's houses for coffee. I couldn't do that. It wouldn't have been right. It wouldn't have been proper. And tongues really would have wagged. So I did avoid that to a large extent. There was a few households that we went to where it was cool and everybody was happy. But I got the feeling from a lot of the mums that I was a novelty to be seen only in the playground.
And okay, so did your children grow up? If that was the 80s, I don't know if they're parents now, but if they're partnered
They're partnered. It was the late 80s when our son Toby was born, 91 when Lauren, our daughter, was born. So they grew up with every other household they went to, there was a mum there. I was the only dad with the households. I don't think there was any restrictions on other people's children coming to our house for playtime and what have you. But they were well enough balanced about it. They didn't see any difference. It was just that's how it was in their household. There was no shame or please, Dad, don't come to the school gates.
Have they grown up?
Absolutely straightforwardly normal.
But I'm saying in terms of like not seeing those same boundaries that perhaps other people grow up with strongly.
Yeah, I'd have to ask them specifically about that. They seem to be well adjusted and they're getting on with life. They both have partners. Neither pair have children yet, but I would imagine that'll happen. But as to who would stay at home with their children, I have no idea. There was one incident where we didn't make a big thing about it. It was just me that was at home. So Lauren came back. She must have been just into reception and came back. And we had a toy vacuum cleaner in the house. And she started pushing it around one day. And she said, I want a vacuum just like Mummy. And I thought, Gina didn't know where it's kept.
I was saying, just like Mommy, fat chance.
If only, If Gina was out doing 14-hour days at the BBC in the studio on long series and what have you, and then coming back, and the last thing she would do would be look for the vacuum. But Lauren was insistent, and that had to have come from school.
Yeah.
It had to. So that's one of the areas. And there was a really fantastic programme on BBC recently about making the classroom gender neutral. And about the expectations for the children themselves, about what they could achieve. Going back to what you were saying about what you can and can't do, is it a male or a female? That shattered that for that one class. But that was one class.
Mm. I was saying, you went back into education, I think.
Yes, yeah.
And we're doing some education coordination from some of our most iconic teenagers who have grown up.
Yeah, I worked for Warner Brothers on Harry Potter and was responsible, not with the best known ones, but I was with the organising the school for the extra children who came in who have to have education when they're on set up until they're 16. We also provided for 16 to 18 for A-levels because we had up to 325 children in on any day. So I had to engage teachers to come into that. And it did feel a bit strange leaving home as stay-at-home dad with less status, with no status, and going into that and heading up. We had 500 children in on a few occasions. So heading up a team of 50 teachers, 500 children, and that felt very strange, that transition from being nothing to something. It was. It took a bit of adjustment.
Mm. Can we talk now about some of your other work?
Yes.
I was interested in particular in Defaced.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Could you describe what the work looks like and what that project is?
This was a series. There are actually hundreds of them. I've had to edit down substantially to get to be a manageable amount. It was in southern India. I was there for a few months in, I think it was 2011. I've been to India quite a number of times, but I'd never really had a good look at the south. So my partner Gina and I went and we travelled around the bottom triangle, And I became aware very quickly that there was lots of posters up which had been on the walls for several years, which had become weathered and then defaced. A lot of them were political posters. Some were advertising, some were obituaries, there were some wanted posters, and they'd all become weathered, but there wasn't the type of weather that we get here, obviously. It was sun bleaching and some rain, but not enough to wash them off the walls. So I think some of them have been there for 5 or 6 years from the political campaign ones, and they take on a very strange, otherworldly appearance. So I think I've narrowed it down to about 25 out of... there are just thousands of them across there. And they are... some are humorous, some are quite spooky, but they all are very strange. I call them defaced because they're all faces. They have been defaced, so it just seemed to work.
Yeah, and they sort of emerge from
they emerge from the wall. Yeah. Some of them, where the dye from the poster has gone into the plaster, it's actually just transferred through and the paper's gone, but we've still got this ghost image in the plaster. I love them. Mm. Really love them.
And speaking of sort of time passing and ghosts, I understand you did a lot of travelling in places like Iran and Afghanistan.
Yes, yeah.
In the 70s.
In the 70s, yes. Before the stay-at-home dad era, I travelled quite extensively through... overland through Turkey, then Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, Nepal, Burma, all the way around there. It was mid-70s, and a few trips.
Some of those places you can't even go
You can, but I wouldn't.
Yeah.
It's northern Pakistan in the Swat Valley and beyond that is now a very definite no-go area, but it is just a superb place. It's such a shame it's all closed off. Northern Afghanistan, in Bamiyan, that was another wonderful, magical place, but that was completely destroyed by the Taliban several years ago, the big Buddhas. All magnificent places to go, but I wouldn't, not now.
Mm. Well, you have your photographs.
I have photographs and memories, yeah. I didn't photograph quite as much when I was across the first time. The second time, certainly, a lot more. I didn't really know where I was going the first time. I didn't know where I was going to. I had originally intended on that trip to go to Greece. And we got to the southern end of Germany.
Took a wrong turn?
Picked the right lift. It was a Lebanese driver who was going out through Iran and dropped us off and... It went on from there. We realised that local transport was very, very inexpensive. Not always reliable, but very cheap. And we just carried on and went to Afghanistan and had a fantastic time.
And thank you so much for sharing your thoughts, your memories, and your photographs.
Thank you for having me.